Welcome to Worlds Apart. Back in 1955, when the Soviet leader Nikita Khrushchev was visiting India, he told his host that Moscow and New Delhi were so close that if the Indians were to call from the mountaintops, the Russians would be at their side. Fast forward almost 70 years, and the Russian-Indian partnership is still going strong despite global upheavals and at times divergent interests. What keeps the two together while also pulling them apart? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Maya Mirchandani, Senior Fellow at the Observer Research Foundation in India. Maya, it's great to see you, great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Happy to be here.
Now, as I mentioned, India has been pursuing its path of strategic balance between Russia or the Soviet Union on the one hand and the West for quite some time. And I think never before has it been so challenging and so rewarding. But you are still arguing in favor of India reducing its reliance on Russia. Why is that?
You've been reading my pieces. Well, I think it's not so much about reducing reliance on Russia as it is about taking positions that are more in keeping with a global outlook on the nature of conflict. So I think there's a distinction to be made. On the one hand, India and Russia, the former Soviet Union, have had a very strong, very deep historic relationship. And I think in the region that both countries inhabit, which is the Eurasian region, there's no question that India needs strong partners. So there is that reality. However, very specifically in the context of, I would say two things. One is the invasion of Ukraine in February this year, and one is a general perception that there is a kind of divergence on definitions of what democracy stands for in the West and in other parts of the world. India is kind of finding itself caught in the middle. It took a very nuanced, very nuanced position on Ukraine. And I don't think it had really any options at that time. In terms of Indian realities, regional realities, foreign policy compulsions, I think it did the best it could. And I'm talking about in February.
Let's talk about that in more detail.
Yeah,
because
sure.
You mentioned these divergent views on conflict. And there is no escaping the fact that India has benefited a great deal from the disruption in the oil trade between Russia and the West, which came as a result of that conflict. Your country has increased its purchases of oil from Russia tremendously, securing pretty large stocks of oil and gas at affordable prices when many countries are struggling with galloping inflation. Do you think that was a wrong move on the part of India?
You know, I don't know if there's any right and wrong in a specific sense in foreign policy, because these decisions are taken keeping many factors in mind. So from the perspective of whether India should have made a stronger alliance with the West against the Russian invasion, it may be seen as something that was deliberate and beneficial. On the other hand, as an emerging economy with its own compulsions of employment and inflation and things like that, the need for reliance on non-Western partners is an Indian reality, and it has been an Indian reality that predates the invasion of Ukraine. So India's position, the idea of strategic autonomy, the foreign policy basis that India works with right now, is basically making the argument that India chooses its partners and allies differently. It chooses its economic relationships differently. So you can even see, for example, that Just now, in this last week alone, India has stayed out of the trade pillar at the Indo-Pacific Economic Forum. And on the other hand, it is taking a leadership role at the Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting that's taking place in Uzbekistan. So India is saying, we're partnering with the Quad on certain things. We're partnering with the SCO.
You're doing the typical balancing that you've been doing for many decades.
Yeah.
Can I ask you quickly about the so-called democratic credentials that, or, you know, democratic values that supposedly pull India towards the West? Because, you know, I would give it fully to India. It's it looks like an authentic democracy. But when we look at the West with not only various democratic practices there in terms of how the governments are being elected, but all those wars launched voluntarily, all the carnage that they have caused, all the insecurity, all the grief that they have brought. As a former war reporter, I'm struggling to marry that with all this rhetoric about, you know, democratic values and a rules-based order. I just don't understand why India needs that kind of sort of Western democratic stand when its democracy itself seems to be more genuine than some of the Western democracies.
Yeah, so, you know, I think that's an interesting question, Oksana, that you've asked me. And you could argue in some way that maybe India is facing an identity crisis of its own, right? From the time of independence, India has had a history of modeling itself on Western liberalism, secularism, individual liberties, and things like that. What we're seeing is a reaction to, you know, a Western-based order coming from our part of the world. And I think when you look at that, the point that you mentioned on the face of it, yes, it's a strong democracy. We have elections every 5 years. There's a huge mandate for this government. There's no question about it. What does a government do with its mandate? A democracy, I keep saying, and this is perhaps applicable to Russia as well, a democracy is not just about the will of the majority. It's also about the protection of the minorities. And so that becomes the baseline. It's about the protection of institutions that support individual freedoms, but that ensure fundamental rights.
I'm sorry for interrupting here. I think many Russians and many Chinese, and frankly, many of my Indian guests have argued that the primary goal of the government is serving the people, and that any government should be judged not so much on the quality of the procedures, although that is important, but on the actual results and on the improvement in the lives of the people. And when we look at the actual figures of people raised from poverty for India, for Russia, for China, the record is pretty strong. The same cannot be said about Western countries, neither about the United States nor about Europe. So are they ultimately democratic? Are they serving their population in this democratic sense?
Yeah, so I think those are valid criticisms, Oksana. There's no question about the fact that those are valid questions. They're valid criticisms. I mean, again, take a look at what happened in the wake of the invasion of Ukraine in February, right? What was the reaction and the commentary from non-Western countries? How is it okay for the West to have gone into Iraq and Afghanistan and the Middle East and blah, blah, blah? And, you know, so there's a hypocrisy in the world order. And I think that hypocrisy is bare and plain for everyone to see. However, for India, I think the question and the challenge is, while there may be a hypocrisy that's laid bare, what is it? What are the values that the Indian democratic system stands for? Mm-hmm. And if the Indian democratic system firmly believes that, you know, aggression or war is not the way to solve border conflicts, or that, you know, minority rights need to be protected everywhere in the world, how do you balance that with the realities of the world that you're living in? So while India manages its strategic autonomy carefully, it does use the idea of Western hypocrisy as a legitimizing factor as well, right? So India can argue that the West cannot impose its alliances and its partnerships on India. India retains the choice to decide whether it wants to engage with Russia. India's regional security, regional economic imperatives are very different. The West is pulled out of Afghanistan. It's not going to come back into that part of the world. India needs a strong, stable neighborhood. Now, does that strong and stable neighborhood also sometimes come at the cost of certain democratic principles? For me, I think that's a really complicated question. There are other statists, nationalists, who will argue that, you know, security is more important and therefore this is okay. So I think it really depends on where on that line you stand.
Let's talk about what you've been referring to as the Russian invasion of Ukraine. In Russia, it's termed as a special military operation. And I think in order to put that into context, we will have to go back to the previous round of confrontation, that is the Cold War. Yeah. Which sure. led to the signing of the final Helsinki Accords in 1975, which were based on the premise of sovereign equality and this principle, the spirit of indivisible security, the spirit that was later abandoned in favor of the American-led hegemonic peace. Now, I know for a fact, and I think it's impossible to argue that this did not happen. The Russians did try to settle their security, their major strategic security differences over Ukraine with the West. Joe Biden and Vladimir Putin met. They spoke over the phone a couple of times, but the West continued militarizing Ukraine. So that was a security challenge for Russia, whether you like it or not. Now, whether Russia's way of settling it it's a good one. I don't think anyone would argue that it was a good one. The war is never a good choice. But do you think those differences that clearly were pretty big in 2021, 2022, do you think they could have been settled without war? Do you think the West would have ever recognized Russia's legitimate concerns of having an anti-Russian state on its border with its leaders talking about developing a nuclear bomb and possibly even a dirty nuclear bomb?
Right. So, you know, Oksana, hindsight is always 20/20. You're asking me if it could have been settled differently. We'll never know the answer to that question, right? That's the reality.
It's a strategic security question.
It's a strategic thing. So I think the thing is, in a sense, to answer, you know, the point that you're raising, when India took the positions it did in February and March and April at the United Nations, on the world stage, the kind of comments you saw from the Indian Foreign Minister, S. Jaishankar, who actually made, you know, it was an off-the-cuff remark, but it got a lot of traction, which is that, you know, Western Europe orders or uses more Russian energy and Russian oil in one afternoon than India does in a whole month, right? So I think India's position takes into account the contradictions that you are talking about, right? Because it recognizes the fact that there is no Western way. Prime Minister Nehru's idea of non-alignment, along with some other countries, was premised on this reality that countries like India were always going to be put in a situation where they would have to make a choice. So how do you insulate younger countries? How do you insulate poorer countries from being overly dependent on one side or the other, and find a way to deal with both as best as possible? So you can make the argument that today's idea of strategic autonomy that our foreign minister and our prime minister talk about is really an adaptation of non-alignment of the 60s and the 70s and the 80s, right? Where when the Cold War was raging, India needed to insulate itself from that. You talk about, you know, Russian realities vis-a-vis Ukraine. These are Indian realities vis-a-vis Pakistan as well. And as a result of that, and now vis-a-vis China, India does not really have a choice but to ensure that its engagement with Russia stays steady. So in that context, I think the idea that, you know, the West is trying to push India to take a very firm stand, I think the West itself has realized that they can't push India to take that stand. And if you notice, conversations and dialogue with Western partners and Western alliances, allies for India, has also changed. And you will find India do that balancing. For example, even I think it was just last week or 2 weeks ago, there was a procedural vote at the United Nations that suggested that, you know, the Ukrainian Premier Zelensky addressed the UN via teleconference or video conference. And on that, there was pressure on India to vote against it. But India said, no, it's OK. Let him address by teleconference. That's fine.
Let us pause here for a second because we need to take a short break. But we will definitely discuss that more in details in just a few moments. Stay tuned.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Maya Merchandani, a senior fellow at the Observer Research Foundation in India. Maya, we've been talking about India's security concerns with both Pakistan and China, and we are recording this interview right at the time when the heads of many Asian nations, including China, including Pakistan, including India, including Turkey, including Russia, are gathering in Uzbekistan for the summit of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. And it's a pretty big geopolitical outing for many of those leaders. It's their first in-person foreign visit after the COVID-19 pandemic. How significant is that in your view?
I think it's hugely significant. Also, don't forget that it's going to be an induction of Iran in this round of the SCO as well. So, look, I mean, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization has positioned itself as a regional grouping for Eurasian countries, Central Asian countries, India, China, Russia. And it's a very interesting grouping because within many of them, there are ongoing conflicts. I remember covering one of the first meetings of the SCO in 2009 when India and Pakistan attended that summit as special guests of the SCO. And Prime Minister Manmohan Singh and President Zardari met on the sidelines of that summit in Ekaterinburg. And, you know, there was a scope that could these summits be used to create a different kind of dialogue process out of the public glare, bilateral conversation within a multilateral framework. So there is no getting away from the fact that this grouping is really important. I think it also underscores India's strategic autonomy that we were talking about just a little while ago, because just about a week ago, India hosted a summit, you know, a meeting of the Quad in Delhi, and where they talked about trade and fair economy and the four pillars of the IPEF. Now, India is making its, you know, you talked about self-interest and national interest. I think strategic autonomy is about national interest. But here is where the hypocrisy comes in that I talked about earlier. Western democracies, Eurasian autocracies, whatever you want to call them, right? Every nation state.
We don't want to call them Asian autocracies, to be honest with you.
every nation state, every sovereign nation state is acting in self-interest today. And I think that is what is posing a challenge to a global rules-based order, because, you know, the question that India asks very often is whose rules is the global order playing by? And the SCO becomes an option and a forum for a different set of countries of the world to say that this is a non-Western grouping. They're all very strong political leaders in their own right in these countries. And they are energy powerhouses, economic powerhouses. They have large populations, you know, and they're saying there is a different part of the world that's saying, let's look at a different grouping. And I think that's where the SCO becomes important.
Interest, them acting in their self-interest is a challenge. I wonder if that is a somewhat outdated mentality because, you know, when most of them, and even if we look at the official goal of the summit, I mean, it sounds somewhat boring and very formal. They're talking about economic cooperation and trade connectivity, but it is taking place at a time when old production chains are being rerouted. And there are new opportunities, like, for example, for India to stock up on, let's say, Russian energy. There are many other opportunities for other countries. I know there's no answers to that, but I wonder what's your intuition. Do you think this drive for synergy, especially at these difficult economic ties, do you think there's a chance that it will overcome the old power grievances, the old spoiler tendencies on the part of some of them? Isn't it in their mutual interest to pursue their self-interest in a mutually beneficial way?
Yeah, I mean, I would say yes, it is. But will there be spoilers? I'm sure they will, because, you know, India is looking at actually also engaging with Iran at this SCO and resuming the oil trade, the energy trade with Iran. It was suspended under the Trump administration under threat of, Western sanctions on India. The China-India relationship is a hostile one. Both countries will argue that they are acting in the national interest, and yet there is you know, an act of military aggression on India's eastern borders by China? Will the SCO be able to put pressure on China as a member state to try and mitigate some of this? Now, if that happens, will China turn around, say for example, and I'm being, you know, I'm speaking hypothetically over here. Say, for example, Russia says China needs to work together with India to resolve a border dispute. Is China going to turn around and tell Russia, well, you walked into Ukraine, why didn't you do what you're telling us to do?
As far as I know, the tone of conversation between the Russians and the Chinese is very different. I think they're putting a lot of premium on their relationship as a container within which differences are resolved. Do you think that could be expanded more broadly throughout the region when the countries would understand that it's in their medium term,
I mean,
to keep the relationship going rather than settle?
I think there is something in that India certainly hopes that Russia can do. You know, these are the three biggest players in that region. Both in terms of, you know, landmass, in terms of economy, in terms of strategic imperatives. So they are the three big players. And I definitely think that the Indian foreign policy machinery sort of looks at ways to get an engagement that would mitigate the China-India tensions somewhat. Can Russia play a role in that? I know that there are meetings scheduled on the sidelines of the SCO summit. I'm not quite sure when they'll take place. We'll probably know more about that as we go along. But, you know, it's also interesting to sort of look at the timing of everything, right? They'll finish with the SCO. The UN General Assembly is happening around the same time. You know, there's lots of things going on in the world, I suppose.
Well, the world is changing very fast. And actually,
very fast, yeah.
I know that you've been somewhat skeptical about the deepening cooperation between Russia and China, especially as Russia distances itself from the West, to put it mildly. But if we actually look at the practicalities of the Russian-Indian partnership, I think it's by far the most progressive in terms of circumventing Western restrictions, because there is already an increased trade in oil and coal, as we mentioned. There are some very novel mechanisms of circumventing insurance pressure. The two countries are also talking about, not just talking, they have already created a mechanism in paying in national currencies. So in terms of the practicalities of cooperation, Russia and India are far ahead than, let's say, Russia and China, to be honest with you.
Yeah, and I mean, also remember that, you know, when it came to sort of military and defense, for example, the Indian government went all out there to ensure that there would be, you know, the requisite waivers would be procured. When it came to, say, the S-400s, for example, the CATSA waiver was something that was very, very, very much talked about in the foreign policy circuit in Delhi. It was a thing that, you know, India had to ensure that it would insulate itself from Western pressure, especially on defense and energy. This is a huge thing.
Let's admit that India has a special capacity to do that, because each camp wants India to its side. Well, the Russians,
that's right,
historically has been pretty amenable and amicable to India's sensibilities, and the Western camp also wants to continue doing business with India. Speaking of which, India assumes the presidency of both the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and G20 later this year. What do you think it can bring to this table at this crucial make or break moment in global history?
Well, what it can bring, that's an interesting question. So I know that, you know, when the conflict first erupted in February, there was a lot of conversations around the possibility of Prime Minister Modi's role personally as somebody who knows and has a good working relationship with Vladimir Putin, as well as somebody who has an engagement with the West. I mean, you know, the US and India call themselves natural allies and natural partners. So there was an expectation, and there might still be an expectation, that India can play that bridge. I mean, you said it very well right now, that, you know, both sides seem to want India to be an active partner.
Absolutely. And is that something... Could that be done without the West actually wanting to put an end to this war. Because, I mean, if you look at Russia's strategic interest, Russia is bleeding. It doesn't want to spend resources on fighting in Ukraine. It needs to come to some sort of amicable security arrangement, you know, to make sure that NATO's troops will not be stationed in Ukraine. And it would be more than happy to put an end to this, you know, brotherly war. I mean, those are families across the border. It's not a foreign country to us. But there are many people both here in Russia, and I heard some analysts even in the West suggesting that the West is interested in prolonging this war as long as possible. First, to weaken Russia. And second of all, to use this opportunity to sort of reset itself, to introduce the kind of draconian or stringent policies that would have been unthinkable a couple of years ago, both in terms of energy saving and in terms of many other social policies. What do you think about that?
I mean, you know, I think lots of analysts say lots of things. I think for the West, it's important to, for the West, to kind of ask themselves what the West perceives as a bigger threat. Is it Russia vis-a-vis Ukraine and what that means for Western Europe? Or is it China and the economic threat that China poses to the entire Western order? And I think that's a conversation that's probably taking place in the corridors of London and Washington and where have you. There is obviously an urgent need globally for some sort of an impasse or an end to the conflict between Russia and Ukraine. And I think that's, we saw even the UN chief speak to Mr. Putin recently. And that's from a humanitarian perspective, leave alone the strategic and the economic and the conflict. That's from the perspective of, you know, food supply chains or energy supply chains impacting ordinary people like you and me. So there is an imperative. Now, you know, so tying this up with the SCO and with G20 and a country like India, which is sort of wanted as a partner by both sides because of the economic potential that India brings to the table, I think India would, you know, want to leverage that in some capacity. Again, coming back to the procedural vote at the United Nations last week, you saw that as India saying, you know, on things that are not very significant, it's fine to take certain positions. And on others, abstention has proven to be the best way forward for India so far, because it sends a message that it's not going to take a side beyond a point. And no matter what the pressure is, either from the West or from Russia, India retains that that autonomy to ensure that the decisions it's taking or the positions it's taking will serve India first. And I think when it comes to that, there is no ambiguity in both the Prime Minister's mind or the Foreign Minister's mind that strategic autonomy means that India is a responsible player on the world stage, but also ensures that its own interests are served.
Maya, we have to leave it there, but thank you very much for this amazing conversation.
Not at all. Thank you for having me, Oksana.
And thank you for watching. Hope to see you again next week on Worlds Apart. We'll be right back.